The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This edition is for November 2020. And the theme this month is A Mill Revival. Gourmet Grits, Carolina Cornbread, Yates Mill, Old Mill of Guilford, Barclay's Mill, and more. We'll see how much we can get to. We're going to start with a holiday of our own. A writer looks back on the Thanksgiving tradition that's stayed with him since grad school. In those days when it was like everything was changing, he and his friends found comfort in a new sense of home. Written by Drew Perry. We called it the pre-Thanksgiving Thanksgiving. We thought we'd invented it, but we were brand new graduate students, freshly arrived in Greensboro and trying to be writers. So we thought we'd invented everything. But the truth is, my mother had conducted pre-Thanksgiving Thanksgivings for years. When I was a kid, we celebrated the holiday proper at both grandparents' houses in Tennessee. Dinner at 6 on my dad's side, dessert at midnight, if we were lucky, on my mother's. And she wanted a Thanksgiving of her own. We ate another full meal then, the week before, with the sides that my parents chose. Simple sweet potatoes, green beans or asparagus, stuffing their way. A simpler meal, less high church, more turkey on the grill. But grad school. We were 25, and as it was for my parents, with their own young family, the idea of where or what home might be was shifting. Some of us were starting to wonder if our writing program might be a kind of home, or if our slope-floored one-bedroom College Hill apartments could be. That fall, we learned fiction and poetry, and also that evenings could be spent with cocktails on front porch sofas. Real sofas, upholstered sofas, sofas that would eventually touch off a sofa war with the neighborhood association. The people on those contraband sofas were beginning to feel like family, what we all took for catechism that fall, two Saturdays before Thanksgiving, was that we wanted some big bash just for us, one where we would celebrate whatever we suddenly were to each other, whatever we were becoming in those intense first few months of school. We did not set a table. The potluck party spilled across two or three apartments and out into the street. Jill brought a silken pumpkin soup. Terry, who had acquired a smoker and so took the lead on the bird, though he let me co-pilot for about 6 in the morning, made 20 pounds of homemade mac and cheese, breadcrumbs on top. Ann and Martin brought beans with Hatch chili peppers in them. They were from New Mexico and had the peppers shipped. I made pearl onions and cream, a dish I don't even like very much, but one so strange and limited in my own family to Thanksgiving that it became sort of a rhyme for the holiday. Tita didn't bring anything. She had not yet moved to Greensboro from Miami, would not join the writing program until the following year, would not come to the first, but the second Carr Street pre-Thanksgiving Thanksgiving. We would get married 9 years later. Maybe somebody made a toast. Maybe there was something like a blessing. The party, as parties often did in those years, stretched well into the night. It was precisely what we would have hoped for had we been old enough to know to hope for it. It was a proper Thanksgiving, People laughed and cried and held on to each other and drank terrible wine and ate almost everything and eventually wandered home, mostly without their dishes. Two people definitely left without their serving spoons. I tried but failed to reunite the spoons with their owners. When they went unclaimed, I kept them. I have used these spoons on Mother's Day for scrambled eggs, and on or about New Year's to serve potatoes with a standing rib roast I'm fond of cooking to ring in the new year. But I like them best at my own young family's Thanksgivings, pre or no. 1 year we had the whole family here for the holiday itself, my brothers and all our kids at tables set end to end, running from the open kitchen to the living room. 1 year we served my parents a very simple turkey and greens a few days early on their way from Atlanta to Virginia. 1 year we celebrated with just the four of us, a simple bird and stuffing, and who knows, the kids were little then, so it might have been Gerber. I tell our boys the story of the spoons every time we get them out, that I know where they came from, but only vaguely. We grad school kids were thrift store hunters then, and our apartments were often passed down with spoons and such left in the drawers. No telling whose these were, no telling where they were before that, but they're ours these days, and they're a thread-thin link to another time, a time before I knew your mom, before I imagined what it might mean to give real thanks. Or maybe this. Maybe they're from a time when I was just learning what my parents already knew. Maybe these spoons are from the first party when I truly understood that Thanksgiving is very much a season, a state of mind, that it can be a November Saturday night, two spoons rattling in the dishwasher, a holiday we've just celebrated, and one that's just around the corner. And now, our state presents the museum's issue, These Walls Talk. An iconic art museum in Asheville, gloriously restored in Pack Square, a tiny mobile museum in Princeville, the nation's first chartered African-American town. A waterfowl museum on the Outer Banks, lovingly rescued from the ravages of hurricanes. Mountains to see, small galleries and big institutions curate conversations about North Carolina. We start with Hickory's masterpiece, the second oldest art museum in the state, started as one man's dream and became a proud anchor in the community, written by Brady Dennis. On that February evening in 1944, the nation remained mired in World War II. The latest wave in a harrowing polio epidemic would soon sweep through Catawba County. But that winter night had brought reason to celebrate. Hickory was opening what only one other city in North Carolina at the time could claim, its very own art museum. A university ensemble sang for the crowd inside the Hotel Hickory. A Lutheran pastor said a prayer. A former governor called the moment monumental in the life of the community. Mayor Walkerly Lyerly described the museum as the latest blessing in a city with a growing list of them. Then he made a prediction. Knowing Hickory people the way I do, he said, I know that this museum will be a complete success and will become one of the best in this country. Listening in the audience that night was the 32-year-old man who had willed that moment into being and who was determined to prove Lyerly right. More than 75 years later, John Carfagno unlocks the entrance at the History Museum of Art, HMA, on a bright weekday morning. Sunlight spills through the windows of the historic former Claremont High School, which has housed the museum and the city's science center for several decades. On the walls hang paintings from the museum's sprawling 2,500-piece collection of American art, mostly from the 19th and 20th centuries. Among them, prized works from famed landscape artist Thomas Cole, impressionist Edward Henry Potast, and master portrait artist Gilbert Stuart. There are also newer acquisitions from contemporary artists like Juan Logan and Joseph Kosuth. Pottery, glass, and metal creations from North Carolina artists adorn one of the gallery spaces. Nearby, the museum's extensive folk art collection unfolds in bursts of color. It features work from artists across the South and also just miles down the road, including that of Minnie Reinhardt, sometimes referred to as the Grandma Moses of Catawba County. Carfagno, the executive director since 2017, beams as he shows off the impressive collection, but he insists that the museum has an asset more valuable than any painting, the community that gives it life and meaning. We want to be so much more than a place where pictures are hung on a wall. We want to be a catalyst for new ideas, new conversations, he says. This should be a place where all people are welcome, included, and engaged. That's a really important social function that can play in a world where empathy and social connectedness are growing increasingly rare. It's a role that the museum has played in this corner of North Carolina for three quarters of a century. Though there's a suggested donation, there's no entrance fee. Generations of school children have not only learned about art here, but they've also seen their own work prominently displayed and celebrated in an annual art show. The galleries have featured well-known national artists, from famed American photographer Steve McCurry to an Andy Warhol exhibit planned for 2021, and also regularly highlights local and regional artists. There are not many cities like Hickory where you can have that kind of exposure to this kind of art and talent and vision, former Mayor Jeff Klein says. It has exposed me to things that I wouldn't get to see outside of a large exhibition in a large city. That's saying something, considering that Klein has traveled to more than 120 countries, and last year saw his own photographs from around the globe featured in an exhibit. It's not what you'd expect in a city of 40,000, Klein says. This is a small city museum that doesn't understand it's in a small city. The COVID-19 pandemic might have forced an unwanted quiet upon the museum during much of 2020, but it didn't bring the creativity within its walls to a halt. On this day, even with the doors closed to the public, local painter and illustrator John David Brown III is busy filling a downstairs gallery with his whimsical, storybook-esque paintings. Upstairs in the museum's main gallery, formerly the high school's gymnasium, a blank canvas that's 75 feet across and 10 feet tall stretches along one wall. We are opening our space to provide a stage for creative and artistic expression that's an outlet for the anguish, distress, and pain that define our world today, as well as the spirit of hope and possibility that will help build a new tomorrow, the museum wrote on its website, inviting people to submit ideas to contribute to the collective project. The goal? To help Hickory turn the angst of 2020 into a living piece of art. We've really worked hard to create engagement with each thing we do, says Clarissa Starnes, the museum's associate director. There is a way to connect through art that is just so powerful and moving. The museum began with a love story. Two, really. In the summer of 1935, Paul Whitener, a son of Hickory, a Duke University football player and a journalism student, found himself in the North Carolina mountains working with the planners of the Blue Ridge Parkway near Little Switzerland. There he met a young art student named Mildred Mickey McKinney. He fell in love with the girl, and he fell in love with painting. Paul and Mickey married the following year, and she encouraged her husband's newfound passion. He pursued some formal art instruction, but he also befriended accomplished artists who helped guide his painting and provided the couple with introductions into the New York art world. By the early 1940s, Whitener had become an adept artist who painted both landscapes and portraits, sometimes on commission, sometimes with Mickey as his model and muse. And he also had grown determined to share his love of art with his hometown. I'm going to make Hickory an art center, he vowed in a 1943 Hickory Daily Record article. Paul was just kind of a force of nature, his niece Julie Klein recalls. He was persuasive. People just had confidence in him. Early on, the Whiteners relied on friends near and far to help get the museum off the ground. One local benefactor helped fund the museum's first acquisition, an oil painting by landscape artist F. Ballard Williams for $140. In 1954, when Whitener learned of an estate auction in New York that included works by prominent American artists, another supporter loaned him $1,000. "And I need your station wagon," Whitener famously added. The trip yielded more than a dozen paintings, among them some of the museum's most treasured pieces. From humble beginnings, HMA eventually moved to a stately Victorian home on Third Avenue. Still, there were hiccups. During one reception, the floorboards in the gallery suddenly gave way, plunging startled guests roughly 2 feet into the foundation below. Luckily, it didn't have a basement. Mickey joked to the State magazine in 1989, reflecting on leaner years. Paul Whitener didn't live to see how much his beloved museum would grow and thrive. He developed a brain tumor in the mid-1950s that paralyzed his right side, though he continued to paint. In 1959, he died at the age of 47. Even as she later remarried, becoming Mickey Coe, his wife stayed on as the museum's director in her 80s. She shepherded it through two moves, a growing outreach and education program, an expanding art collection, and in 1991, a national accreditation from the American Association of Museums. "We didn't just do this overnight," Coe, who died in 2008, once said of what people had accomplished together. "We have earned our niche in the world of art." The Whiteners' spirit still lingers in the institution they nurtured for more than half a century. The museum's main gallery is named in honor of Mickey Coe. The annual student art show carries Paul Whitener's name, and in a hallway outside the staff offices, a small portrait of him hangs, movie star handsome, a daily reminder of the outsized ambition that has existed from the start. "He was bold enough to say that Hickory deserved a top-notch museum," Carfagno says. "Our whole team still lives and breathes that." Although the museum has evolved over the years and broadened the scope of its exhibitions, there remains an unmistakable mission: to make art accessible and stimulating, not stale and stuffy. "This is what Paul envisioned, and this would be an exceptional museum," says Jeff Klein, the former Hickory mayor. Julie Klein, Whitener's niece, acknowledges that some things might surprise him if he popped in here from the 1950s, and that's okay. Times change, but she thinks he'd be delighted by the museum's creativity, vitality, and inclusiveness. It's the spirit and the idea of wanting a lot of different people to participate and learn, she says. "I think it's even more true now than it was in his time." On most mornings, Starnes arrives early to check the temperature and humidity in the building's storage vault and across its more than 10,000 square feet of galleries. There, among the sea of paintings, she feels at home. "That's a very spiritual experience," she says, adding with a laugh, "I do talk to the art, and I tell Paul good morning when I walk through." A Hickory native, Starnes grew up knowing little about the museum in her backyard. It was meant for people with a certain background, she assumed then, or for those who knew more about art than she did. Now she couldn't feel more differently. "That's a stigma that's so unnecessary," she says. "We would never want anyone to live in this community and have the same story I did. I want it to be an experience for people, and my hope is that it is always a life-changing experience." Like Whitener, she discovered in art a life-altering experience of her own. And like Whitener, sharing that with the people of Hickory has become a calling. "It's so important to keep this going because it's so valuable," Starnes says. "I feel a responsibility to make people love it as much as I do." You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. And if you have any comments, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Let's see if we can whip through this next article up here on page 160. I was going to do something else, so I wasn't prepared to flip the pages here, but let's just see if this one will fit. First in Freedom, a new mobile museum helps visitors understand the deep history of the country's first incorporated African-American town, its faith born of resilience, and more important, its hope for the future. Written by Latria Graham. If you traveled this road before 2019 and didn't know what you were looking for, you would miss a major piece of North Carolina's black history. Tucked into the south bank of a bend in the Tar River at the intersection of U.S. Highways 258 and 64 in Edgecombe County sits a little silver historical marker with the words Freedom Hill written on the top. A little bit farther down to, or rather 64, which also doubles as the small town's main street, a bigger green sign reads, Welcome to Princeville, oldest town chartered by blacks in America, home of historic Freedom Hill. A new project created with students at the North Carolina State University of Architecture's Design and Build Studio aims to change the way people passing through see this town. Along the highway is an arresting structure, a 200-square-foot mobile unit covered in patinaed Corten steel. Emblazoned across its side is the date 1885. This is Princeville's new museum. When visitors step inside, the story of the town comes alive. After the Civil War and emancipation, hundreds of formerly enslaved people made their way to this patch of swamp next to Tarboro. The land was considered to be of little value, but the Union Army was stationed there, and these people were seeking protection and trying to figure a new way of life. With little more than the clothes on their backs, they decided to make this place their new home, helping one another build shelters and tend the land to be able to feed their growing community. Turner Prince was a carpenter. Formerly enslaved, he's credited with creating some of the first buildings at Freedom Hill. Slowly the land awakened. Homes went up, as did grocery stores, juke joints, churches, and a hotel. When Freedom Hill was incorporated, the citizens decided to name their new town after the pioneering builder who helped make it possible. They called it Princeville. Early residents turned the area into a thriving community, and current residents still hold great pride in the innovations and creativity that allowed the first settlers to transform something once thought to be worthless into something beautiful. But the people of this low-lying land have always had one enemy, water. Princeville's proximity to the Tar River meant minor flooding whenever it rains and major flooding when there's a hurricane. The people living here have always found ways to survive, to work with the water, but as the storms that come their way get larger, the resilience of Princeville's residents is starting to wear thin. Many residents thought Hurricane Floyd would be the apocalyptic event of their lifetime. In 1999, that storm, which spawned off the coast of Cape Verde, sent the Tar Heel River cresting to 42 feet, overwhelming the dike that was built in 1965 to protect the town. The water came at night, and it had never been so high. The dark currents from the Tar seeped into homes, threatening to carry away people's belongings, their history, their photos. It took 10 days for the place to dry out. Most folks came back to rebuild. Then came Hurricane Matthew. It started in late September 2016 as a tropical wave off the coast of Africa. But by October 1st, it was a Category 5 hurricane moving through the Caribbean, churning up water, eating up ground, and ripping the roofs off of homes. When it reached the North Carolina coast, its winds pushed the water up the river systems in the region. And the 14 inches of rain that battered Edgecombe and surrounding counties sent the Tar River surging, cresting at 36 feet, overwhelming the protective dike once again. Princeville, for the second time in 20 years, was underwater. The clouds dissipated, the sun came out, eventually the town dried up, and the people living along the Tar started to pick up the pieces. With two biblical floods in two decades, fewer people returned to rebuild. The town's residents wondered if the world had forgotten about Princeville. Some have moved on. Linda Whitest lost just about everything in the 1999 flood. Clothes, furniture, old family photos, the water from the 2016 hurricane didn't come up as high, so she got to keep a few pieces of the artwork she'd been collecting for almost two decades. Still, when she was offered the chance to rebuild in Princeville a second time, she declined. Even though her family had lived here for more than 100 years, Whitest chose to leave. Surviving storms changes people, mentally, physically, she said. I just cannot go through it again. The town's officials wonder about what has been lost. Most of the buildings need major repairs. The Welcome Center remains closed. The old Princeville Museum sits vacant, its walls having been ripped out so that the structure could dry fully. The floors are just slats of ancient wood, not meant to be walked on. All of the displays are gone. When Kofi Boone, a professor of landscape architecture and an environmental planning at NC State, brought a group of students that he worked with to Princeville in 2018, the teens were dismayed to find that there was little left of the town they'd heard so much about. A couple of overgrown yards, neglected cemeteries, and precious few houses. With the town's buildings still boarded up, there was nothing to tell the story of this historic place. The students were left with a desire to learn more. If this were Jamestown or some other major first in America, Boone says, there would be no question about protecting it. We've got to do everything we can to protect and nurture this place because it's an important part of history. Serendipity is a precious thing. It means that things prayed for can be made real. It makes hope tangible. When a building project that the students of Design Plus Build Studio normally undertake in the summer months fell through, Boone remembered Princeville and encouraged a collaboration. Guided by instructors Ellen Cassidy, Eric Melman, and Randy Lanou, the students came up with the idea of the Mobile Museum, which could be a traveling education exhibit and could be moved if the town flooded again. The group decided to make the structure out of Corten steel because when the material meets water, it rusts and hardens, protecting the structure underneath, a nod to the town's strength in the face of natural disasters. Town manager Glenda Knight likes that the museum considers Princeville's needs. When a dwindling tax base, the town can't provide a full-time docent for the museum. But in the mobile unit, she says everything there is self-explanatory. It's a condensed version of the old museum. We have portraits of humanity here displaying different people of the community. Curtis Murphy's portrait is one of those featured in the Mobile Museum. He and his wife won't buy good furniture anymore because they know the town could flood again. But this is home. Always has been, so they return. Their love story started when Curtis saw Augusta at a Princeville card game. For more than 40 years, they've loved and lived here. There have been calls to move the entire community. Murphy is against that idea. If they move this town, Princeville won't be Princeville anymore, he says. The town's fate is still undetermined. Hurricane season is underway, and while federal funds for a better levee system have finally been approved, there's much to be done. The Mobile Museum is one way to help preserve the town, a way for people across North Carolina and the entire nation to learn the story of America's oldest black municipality. If you're interested in visiting the Princeville Mobile Museum, it's at 310 Mutual Boulevard in Princeville, North Carolina. They have a website, princevillemuseum.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.